Happy Friday, May the 9th. But look, if you were hoping the cold weather that's hit most of us was on its way out the door, I am terribly sorry to inform you that it looks like most of us are still in for some freezing temperatures today and tomorrow as well, thanks to a little something called a polar jet stream that really does seem to be doing what it says it does on the tin and providing us all with the coldest temperatures of the year so far. Thank you so much, Polar Jetstream. We are so lucky to have you. Kia ora, this is Newsable. I'm Imogen and this is What's Worth Talking About. It's back to the future with the return of a National Party policy of years gone by. So, what is social investment and does it work? Baby Reindeer is on track to becoming Netflix's most popular TV series ever. Why are we so obsessed with it? Jeff Wilson's into Chad ahead of this weekend's top of the table Super Rugby Pacific clash, and it's Eurovision finals weekend, so who is tipped to win? All that's coming up in a moment here on Newsable.
Newsable takes time and resources to produce. Please support our mahi and visit stuff.co.nz/support.
We are having a flashback moment in government policy, with the Finance Minister announcing a return to a policy of an earlier national government, social investment.
So today I'm announcing that we will establish a new social investment agency to replace the Social Wellbeing Agency, effective from 1 July this year. This standalone central agency will lead the development of social investment across government, helping us achieve better results from our social service expenditure with smarter use of data, evidence and analytics.
It was a favourite of a previous finance minister, Sir Bill English, and involves gathering and using data and evidence-based investment practices for our social services. But what does that all mean on the ground? To help us unpick this returned policy, we're joined by Max Rashbrook, a senior research fellow at Victoria University's School of Government, who writes extensively on inequality. Kia ora, thank you for your time.
No problem, glad to be here.
Max, how does social investment work?
Well, the basic concept is very, very simple. It's saying that we should look at the social problem programs the government provides, so the welfare services, the services to families, education, healthcare, all of those things, try to establish whether they work or not, what their outcomes are across a range of measures, and then fund the ones that work and stop funding the ones that don't work.
Oh, it sounds very sensible, doesn't it? Gathering data so we know what's going on and who needs help. How well did it go under Sir Bill English's time?
It kind of first came on our consciousness, I guess, in 2011, when Paula Bennett released a welfare report that said, look, all these people on welfare are going to cost us billions and billions and billions of dollars over the long run, and we need to get them off welfare as quickly as possible. And this kind of gave social investment a bit of a bad name, particularly for people on the left, because it just resulted in people being kicked off benefits with no real concern about what happened to them afterwards. And then as that national government developed throughout the 2010s, it started to turn into something more like what you would actually call social investment, saying, okay, well, where is government money best spent to help people achieve these social outcomes? So it was starting to become something more coherent just at the point when National got tipped out of government in 2017.
Are there any differences then in what Nicola Willis is proposing this time round?
It's pretty similar on the face of it. There's a very distinct back to the future flavour about it. That National had a social investment agency. Labour came in, called it the Social Wellbeing Agency. National's going to take it back to its original name of the Social Investment Agency. And mostly the ideas are pretty similar. National has talked about this idea of having a social investment fund, which would have government money in it, but which in some quite nebulous and undefined way, private investors might also put their money into, or philanthropists might, if they want to help fund things, which I personally think is very strange. If there are things that government should be delivering, because they're public programs and people are entitled to them as of right, then that should be funded out of the public purse, and we should leave philanthropy to do philanthropic things. And there's real dangers in introducing private money particularly if it's, you know, going to be involve people chasing profits.
You've just touched on one part there, but if you had to give a report on the policy, which is still in planning stages this time around, what would you say are the good points and what would you say might be cause for concern? Like I said, you've just touched on one there.
I think the basic concept is unobjectionable. And I do think we have a problem in New Zealand, or indeed most governments probably have the difficulty that it's not always clear what value they get from their spending. In particular, I think there's a lot of programs delivered to poorer families, which probably don't work particularly well because they're not well suited to those people's lives. Social investment could ideally help bring some better discipline to public spending. The big problem, though, is in this idea that we can define very exactly what happens from government programs. Because government programs are trying to help people with very complex lives, all sorts of things are going on, and if these programs are going to have impacts, it could be over 5, 10, 20 years, and we may simply not have that data. So it could go very badly wrong with government saying, well, we can't instantly prove in the first year that this program has transformed the life of poorer families, so we're going to cut it, even though it's something that we have good reason to think could and probably will be transformative over the longer period. The other problem with social investment is it can lead you to focus on very, very small programs which might have had one journal article written about, you know, showing that they achieved, you know, some kind of social return. And it could lead you to miss the impact of huge sweeping social change. As people have pointed out, if Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement had had to prove the social return on investment that would be made from removing discrimination, they might never have got anywhere.
Really great to speak with you about all of that, Max Rashbrook. Thank you. Another note about the weather. I promise I'll stop banging on about it soon. If you are chilly this Friday morning, the plea is for you to put some layers on instead of the heating, because the electricity grid is under pressure, which is never great news. But hey, remember, if you did want to ever get in touch, you can email me as well. Maybe on your data instead of your Wi-Fi, if we're trying to conserve power this morning. Imogen@newsable.co.nz. It may have dropped on Netflix a month ago now, but the TV show Baby Reindeer is still top of the streaming platform's charts and is on track to become one of Netflix's most popular shows of all time. The semi-autobiographical seven-part series, written by and starring comedian Richard Gadd, follows struggling comic Donnie, played by Gadd, as he's stalked and harassed by a woman named Martha. Now, I hated every minute of this show. However, I also could not tear my eyes away from it. So why has it become so popular, and have we, the viewers, interpreted it the right way? Just a warning here, we are going to talk about grooming and sexual abuse. So if you did want to skip, now is the time to do so, about 3 or 4 minutes or so. Alex Simpson is a criminology lecturer at Macquarie University in Sydney, and he's here now to share his thoughts. Kia ora, welcome to Newsable.
Cheers, thank you for having me.
Alex, why can't we get enough of Baby Reindeer? I just said I hated every minute of it, and yet I had to watch it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That was exactly my experience. I was kind of watching it with my partner. We did it in one day, I think. After every episode, we looked at each other and kind of check it. Are we enjoying this? Do we want more of this? But yet we let Netflix roll on and do it. I mean, it is a wonderful program. I think it's a wonderful bit of television. And it does so much in terms of speaking about trauma, male victimization, of sexual abuse, all those things. But I think there's also this sense that we do have this fascination around trauma, around victimization, but specifically around women and crime and female offenders. I think this is one of the things that kind of drawn us to it, and around the role of Martha and what she's like. But I think it kind of speaks to so many other things around kind of our understandings around gender and crime, especially offending.
As I said in the intro, the series, for those who haven't watched it, is based on the real life stalking of Richard Gadd by a woman who the show names as Martha. That's not her real name. You've written a piece, Alex, for The Conversation titled "Martha Isn't Baby Reindeer's Biggest Villain, Yet She Is the One Who Carried Out the Relentless Harassment Campaign." Can you explain why you then came to that conclusion?
Well, I think for those who watch the show, there is this pivot where Richard Gadd, or in the program, Donnie's kind of history of sexual trauma is revealed, and how it's revealed kind of perniciously through kind of grooming as he's trying to kind of make his way as a kind of a comic, but also a writer. and he is groomed by this other TV producer, this TV writer. There is this really kind of interesting way in which the program hangs on that close relationship. It kind of helps us understand that kind of complicated relationship between Donnie and Martha, because there are ways in which Donnie is complicit in this.
Why do you think we haven't seen the same outrage towards the character who repeatedly groomed and drugged and sexually assaulted Gad slash Donnie, the main character, the one you've just touched on?
Yeah, we are kind of fascinated by, if I can call it, kind of feminine evil. We're kind of drawn to them more than their male counterparts because they are unrepresentative. Kind of women fundamentally don't do this. We kind of view male offending as kind of autonomous, as kind of independent, almost rational. We kind of factor it into kind of male behavior, and that's kind of grim in its own sense. But when women commit the same crimes, we kind of view it in a whole different light. It's unrepresentative, so we're drawn to it like a moth to the light.
Goodness me, this TV series has captured the attention of everyone, it seems. So great to talk with you and get you to unpack all of that. Alex Simpson, a criminology lecturer at Macquarie University in Sydney.
Kia ora, I'm Adam Blair. I played the great game of rugby league for the Storm, Tigers, Broncos and the Mighty Warriors.
And I'm Goran Paladin, sports presenter and rugby league fanatic.
I won a World Cup too. I played 51 tests for New Zealand.
Yeah, he's a national treasure, people. Come on. Bleary and I, we're joining forces for a brand new rugby league podcast called League of Our Own.
Each week we talk Kiwis across the NRL and of course everything Waz.
All the big names, the big stories.
And some of my own stories too.
Well, if we can make them fit.
We'll make time.
Okay. League of Our Own with Bleary and Goran. Proudly brought to you by Snap Rentals.
You can listen through stuff.co.nz or wherever you get your podcast.
Mate, your stories are way too long, eh?
Nah, we've got to take them on a journey.
Oh, the journey. Yeah, of course.
Remember when I said earlier in the week that things could get messy in this rap diss track battle that's going on between Drake and Kendrick Lamar? Well, one of Drake's security guards has been shot and seriously injured outside of the musician's Toronto home. It's important to note that police say it is too early to speak about a motive, but if you want to know more about what's going on and how we got here, get Wednesday's episode in your ears. And while you're at it, chuck Newsable a like and a follow wherever you get your podcasts so that you never miss an episode. There are just four rounds to go before the Super Rugby Pacific quarterfinals begin. And this weekend, we have a stellar lineup with a top-of-the-table clash between the Blues and the Hurricanes. And then we have the little treat of a South Island derby with the Highlanders taking on the Crusaders. Rugby legend and Sky commentator Jeff Wilson is back once again to chat about the sporting weekend ahead. Welcome back, welcome back. What's cracking?
What's cracking is the fact the two ends of the table are what we're talking about there. True. We've got the top of the table and then we've got the bottom of the table. The Highlanders just above that, to be fair, and we would never have imagined probably, I suppose, a couple of months ago that this would be the weekend we'd be looking at. And a team's fighting for survival and the other two teams are fighting to maybe be the number one team in Super Rugby as you head towards the playoffs. So, look, it seems as though the way this season has worked out, every match has got something riding on it, you know, and that ultimately means you've got a good competition and the results are unpredictable. And particularly for me, I've looked hard into this game at Eden Park and I can't find a clear winner easily.
What are you expecting to see, though, between those white lines with the Blues and the Hurricanes hitting Eden Park tomorrow afternoon? Just pure fire?
Well, yeah, I was going to say a war up front. I mean, essentially, that's where it's going to start. And you've got one team that's been defensively awesome, the Blues, throughout the course of the season. But you've got a Hurricanes team that's playing with incredible confidence. They know who they are and what they're capable of. Both teams have really pretty much got full strength side, other than Stephen Perafita and Rico Ioane not being available for the Blues. But the Blues have been great regardless. So these are the sort of games that, if you're Scott Robertson, if you're a rugby fan, you can't wait to see.
And then, of course, down south, Highlanders v Crusaders. What are you expecting there? I mean, up the Highlanders, obviously.
Yeah, up the Landers. Let's be honest. Clearly my heart is well and truly saying, let's go the Highlanders. But what have they welcomed back into their fold, the Crusaders? They've got Tamaiti Williams coming back and Scott Barrett's recovered from injury. And they've got Cody Taylor. Mm. So all of a sudden, their forward pack is looking really formidable. And when they've had guys available, they have been able to compete clearly with everybody. But they have to win this game if they've got any shot. So the Highlanders have had a morale-boosting win, a couple of wins now on the bounce, but against the bottom two sides, you know, in this competition. This is the Crusaders game where if you're going to make a statement, and I feel as I've said that for like 2 months, yeah. If you're going to make a statement.
This is the weekend to
now's
do it.
Now's the game. Maybe, you know, and look, I've been hanging in there with them.
You have. You have, to be fair.
I don't know if they don't win this game. There'll be a smile because the Islanders have won, but I'll be disappointed with the Crusaders because this might mean that their season is pretty much done.
I don't know. You might be the squeaky wheel they need. Let's talk some other sport. There are a couple of other notable games this weekend. The Black Ferns are playing their first test of the year against the US in the Tron. Big ups, Hamilton. What sort of match are you expecting there?
I think this Black Ferns team is incredibly talented, is really deep. The USA are competitive and you know, they'll come in and throw everything they can at this Black Ferns team. But I'm expecting at home in Hamilton, with the sort of preparation they've had, they spent quite a bit more time together in Super Rugby Opiki and now in camp as well. I'd expect them to win and win pretty well.
We can't not mention the Wally Phoenix as well, playing the first leg of the A-League semi-final against the Melbourne Victory. Nail-biting stuff. Do you reckon the Wally Phoenix can still secure their first ever grand final appearance?
You'd have to say so. I mean, the form throughout the season has been the one thing you want is consistency and the fact that you don't end up one of the top two spots if you haven't played well on a consistent basis. I say bring it on.
Jeff Wilson, rugby legend and Sky commentator, thank you for your time. And of course, if you wanted to catch any of those matches this weekend, Sky has live and exclusive coverage of them all. Some might feel it's a bit cheesy. Others find it irresistible. I am, of course, talking about Eurovision. It's the finals this weekend and the entries are, as always, pretty varied. I feel it coming. So who's in the running to win? Who are the crowd faves? And how political is the competition turning out to be? To help us out is Eurovision fan Stuff's James Croat. James, this is a competition known for the weird and wonderful. So who's been catching your Eurovision eye?
I have to say the Albanian kind of Gaga-esque tune that they have is a particular favourite for the particularly wacky and with the touch of its own ethnicity and cultural leanings. The Armenian entry is certainly not to be dismissed.
That one has no lyrics.
Yeah, exactly. But that's part of the charm.
Yeah, exactly.
But our secret favourite is my part home country, being half Dutch, the Netherlands Europapa is just that perfect mix of kitsch and just so dancey, it's not funny. It may as well be Aqua's Barbie Girl for this decade.
Remember I said weird and wonderful and varied, the songs? So those are your faves. Are there fan favourites? Are there firm fan favourites that have shaped up already?
I believe the Swiss entry, which I think is a bit of transgender dance floor pop, I think is a particular favourite amongst the crowd so far. The Swedish are always favourites, of course. They're the hometown this time. Malmo is where it's being held. If they win, they will become the greatest country ever in Eurovision history. It's also 50 years since ABBA's Waterloo too.
Just quickly, my favourite's Baby Lasagna, the band from Croatia, their song Rim Tim Tuggy. Then I also like Finland's entry. I think I just love the silly songs. Is Eurovision still popular in Europe and I guess globally as well?
I think it's still has huge popularity. They've tried to make it more global. We can now vote as part of it. Yes, which is actually one of the downfalls of Eurovision in the past couple of years. Ukraine won it 2 years ago, and that was very much based on the popular vote rather than the beauty of Eurovision in its old format was that each country voted for everyone else. I don't know. It's just not quite what it was. It all feels a bit fixed.
And a bit political, especially this year.
So, oh, it's always been political.
Yeah, but Russia obviously wasn't allowed to take part in Eurovision after it invaded Ukraine. Now it's Israel that's attracting controversy because it's been allowed to take part despite opposition. What's the latest there?
The Israeli song was originally called October Rain, which isn't a prequel to the Guns N' Roses tune, but rather a reference to what took place in October. And there are lots of talk within the lyrics of wanting to see you again, which is a reference to the hostages. But this is very much a pro-Israel, not an anti-Israeli government kind of tune. They've changed it to Hurricane. My kids and I want to call it Harry Kane just because he's such an icon. But, you know, it's hard to take the politics out of this song, no matter which way they've tried to schmooze that over. And, you know, I think it'll come a cropper because of that.
All right, so who, putting everything else we've talked about aside, who is going to take out the votes this year?
I want the Dutch to win. Everybody's going to have their favourites, but I'm just hoping that music and Europe will be the winner on the day.
Oh, that's a good note to end on, James Groot, Eurovision superfan and Stuff's telly and film reviewer. Great to catch up.
No worries.
Let's just end on a little bit of Finland song for my enjoyment, shall we?
Windows 95, man, and I only play one role at the rules. No rules.
That is Newsable for today. I'm Imogen Wells, and how could I forget? Up the Wahs, who are also playing this Sunday. Let's go. No rules.
If you like this podcast, please support our work. Visit stuff.co.nz/support.
It appeared that a vehicle may have gone over the 80-metre cliff into the sea.
There have been no bodies found despite considerable debris being washed ashore.
9 years ago, a man named John Breckinridge abducted his stepson, Mike Zhao Breckinridge. Soon afterwards, they vanished. Nearly a decade later, there is still no sign of Mike or John and no agreement about their fate.
The family believe that they are residing overseas under new identities.
The court should find that sadly Mike and John Breckinridge have died as a result of the vehicle being driven off the cliff.
Now, a new investigation is trying to find out what happened to them.
From Stuff Audio and the Press newspaper, this is The Lost Boy, the disappearance of Mike Zhao Breckinridge. Listen on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.